say a few words about the shadow. It's really very interesting. And what the shadow is as a result of the self-contraction being overactive, some component of the authentic self, which is not the real self, the authentic self, is cut off, dissociated, and thrown out of the self system, either into the unconscious or projected. It's still unconscious, projected onto people or things in the environment. Now, first of all, the difference between the authentic self and the real self, or the unique self, or the true self. The unique self, the true self, the real self is the infinite self. The self without boundaries, without limits, pure emptiness, looking out through a particular set of eyes. And it's the realization of that true or unique self that is the aim and the goal of all of the great paths of liberation. Now, unfortunately, what a lot of those paths do is they confuse any finite self with an ego in a negative, anti-spiritual sense. And so they miss the fact that even when you realize the ultimate self, the true self, the unique self, that's your infinite self. But it's still a manifestation. And there's a conventional self that works in that manifest realm. And it's the everyday self. And it's a self that's in relationships with other manifest selves and with the manifest world itself. And it's directly part of your own unique individuality. And that's why a lot of people would get confused when Carl Jung actually used the phrase individuation for transcendental growth. People don't put them together. They sound too opposite. So you either have a self or you have transcendence, but you don't have both. But in fact, you do have both. You have the union of emptiness and form. And so you have two selves, just like you have two truths, ultimate and relative. Now, in the two truths doctrine, there are, in a sense, three perspectives on any one thing. One is to see it as the infinite. And the other is whether in the manifest realm, whether it's true or whether it's false. So if there's a rope coiled up in the corner in its dimly lit room, and you think that's a snake, that's an example of false relative truth. Turn the light on, see it's a rope, and say that's a rope. That is a true relative statement. And ultimately, both of them are Brahma. So the ultimate truth is whatever it is you're seeing is Brahma. Well, the two selves follow that exactly same pattern. The ultimate self can't be true or false. It just is. And it is radically beyond a duality of true or false. But then the relative self can be a true, correct self-image. The rope is a rope. Or it can be a false, incorrect self-image. The rope is a snake. And the activity that converts this true, authentic self into a false self is the activity of the shadow. So false self plus shadow equals authentic self. And awakening means realizing your authentic self and your real self, or your true self, or your unique self. And that's where most of the traditions fall down. They acknowledge only one or the other self. So Western psychotherapeutic traditions all acknowledge an authentic self, and that's what they try to get for you. But they are unaware of, or usually even deny, the existence of a true self, a real self, an infinite self. And the great traditions often do the opposite. And they acknowledge only a unique self, only a transcendental self. And they don't allow any manifestation of an authentic individual self. And so all that really gives you, when you awaken to emptiness, is a repression of your own unique self, part of your own unique self that's attempting to manifest in the relative realm. Gets denied. Any small self is a nasty self-contraction. And so instead of using spirituality to help you awaken to your unique self and express it authentically in the relative realm, in your authentic self, and using spirituality to deny that expression in the relative realm, and that basically it gives that kind of spirituality that's just kind of wishy-washy and airy-fairy and never really touches down. It's nothing but transcendental. There's no eminence in it. There's no grounding. There's no agape. And it just, the person seems sort of ethereal, not really real, not really present. And there are some traditions that are sort of worse at that than others. Theravada Buddhism is pretty bad at allowing the authentic. So it doesn't allow self at all. So it's pretty problematic in that tradition. Zen, on the other hand, Rinzai Zen tends to produce really powerful realizers. And if you could know it or not, it's because they have a doctrine of true self. And so they actually understand self, but they don't actually theoretically explain the authentic self and the true self. But by allowing the true self in, they inadvertently allow the authentic self in as well. And so for a Buddhist school, they're not kind of the airy-fairy. They're pretty much the opposite. They're very, very grounded. So it's been a real, real issue, because in addition to the authentic self and the true self, there's the self-contraction. And that's the third item in this self zoo. And of all of them, it's the culprit. The self-contraction is what squeezes the authentic self so hard that it pushes the shadow out. It's just almost that simple. It's the true self, authentic self, self-contraction, closed-fisted. And that self-contraction is what almost everybody means when they say the ego. And then they'll usually confuse that with the authentic self and make both of them bad. They both become, you know, the ego, which is a bad self-contracting thing. And in fact, the ego, all it is a Latin for I. And that's why Fichte talked of the pure ego. And by that he meant what Ramana Maharshi called the I-I, which literally could be called the ego-ego, the ego-ego. And that would be the I-I, the ultimate self. So, and then the ego can also be used in psychoanalytic sense. For the scholastics, the Catholic theologians of the Middle Ages, the ego, or the self, is that which gives unity to the mind. So it's a very important function. And in fact, that's essentially what it does. The ego, meaning as authentic self, is that which gives unity, wholeness, to the manifest self. And whenever the self contraction gets too overwrought, too overdone, too contracted, then it really will just cut off, squeeze out aspects of the authentic self that should be on the inside of the eye boundary, and they go on the outside of the eye boundary. And so it goes from a first person to a second person. It's some other thing to a third person. A she, him, her, it, but not an I. And the shadow is produced by this overactive self-contraction, and through, more specifically, things called defense mechanisms. And defense mechanisms, simply the form that the self-contraction takes at each level of development, level of consciousness, level of awareness. And so whatever the form of cognition at that level, that's what the defense mechanism will be made of. So that cognitive develop goes from images to symbols to concepts to rules to meta-rules and on up the scale into overmind and supermind. And so the first cognitive form emerges about 7 months or so, and that's images. An image is different from a symbol in that an image looks like the thing it's representing, and a symbol doesn't look like the thing it's representing. So it's a harder task. So images come first. So if you form an image of that mountain, you close your eyes, you can still form an image. These are all enduring structures. And so you can create an image just by looking at something, closing your eyes, and imagining it. And when that's the only cognitive structure available, that's the only thing that the self-contraction can work on. And so images are what's responsible for the earliest of self-boundaries. You have an inside and an outside. And there are some more primitive ones. We'll just pick it up with images, which are the first major cognitive structures. And so work is a good example. And what self-contraction does there is it will shift the boundary away from anything on the interior is causing pain or suffering or discomfort. Now, of course, manifestation itself is dukkha. Everything suffers in the manifest realm when left to its own devices. So just the fact that you're born means you're born into suffering. You're born in original sin. And it doesn't matter if you goofed up or not. You selected to be a separate self, authentic or not. You have chosen to forget your true self, and therefore you are in a world of hurt. And the selection to move away from that ultimate whether that's made in the womb or in the bardo realm during the afterlife state, however you want to conceive whenever the first separate self gets going. Well, there's a self-contraction that is part of that. And so, just being a separate self and splitting yourself apart from the external world, that's already the first action of an illusion. It's already a first lie, in a sense, which is what the shadow is all about. And the shadow is about deception, how we deceive ourselves about who we are. So by the time we hit the ground running, we're already caught in some form of self-deception, in the sense that we don't know our real self. We don't know our absolute, ultimate, true self. But we do have a chance to be more or less true in the relative realm. So we can be more or less authentic or false self. So with images, the boundary is shifted around. And if there's something on the interior that is extremely painful, it's through images pushed to the outside and is projected. And in other cases, the self's also very vulnerable to taking something from the outside that should stay on the outside. Parents' actions of being overly angry all the time as an emotional response. It'll take that and internalize it or interject it. So on the hierarchy of defenses that you'll see in all the psychodynamically oriented psychotherapies have essentially the same hierarchy of defenses. And they start with interjection and projection. And they work on up to formal operational thinking with sublimation. And in between, you get association and denial and repression and sublimation. And that's what's happening. That hierarchy is simply the types of contracting activity that are produced first by images, then capacity for symbols emerge, and symbols start to become really prevalent about the beginning of the second year of life, and with the emergence of language. And one of the first words, oddly enough, that the infant uses is no. So this symbol no becomes a it can be used in a very healthy way, but it's also made to order for dissociation, for pushing something out of the self. And so with the emergence of symbols, we have a more complex form of self-denial, capacity for dissociation. And the most common form of defense mechanism at any level is projection. It's simply one of the foundational forms, and it's just the earliest that comes into play. So you can have projection occurring at virtually any level past the first year or so. And after symbols are concepts. And concepts are symbols that represent a class of objects. So the word dog is a concept. It represents a whole class of doggy things. The word Fido is a symbol because it represents just one thing. So symbols denote, concepts connote. So from Fido to dog is to move from symbol into concept. And with concept, we are at fulcrum 3. And the capacity for real classic repression in the Freudian sense of an impulse that wants to come up but is pushed down. And repression is a very powerful form of self-contracting. As a matter of fact, it can't occur until fulcrum 3. Fulcrum 2, the types of therapies there are called structure-building techniques because the self-boundary is still fairly weak and fluid. And so the object of therapy at fulcrum 2 is actually get a person up to the level of being able to repress something. That's a step forward when the self can engage in repression. It can't do that at fulcrum 2. It just has images and symbols, so it can just push stuff around. It's not strong enough to actually clamp it down. But concepts are. They're very powerful cognitive structures. And so it's one of the major sources of shadow generation that occurs. And we're talking here around ages 5, 6, 7. And this is where a lot of people's problems go back to that early age. And the therapies that don't work by reaching down that far just don't really get at the problem very well. So it's a tricky developmental area, and it's one of the most exposed, and it's one of the most active places for the self-contraction. And it's also the point where the mind and body are starting to differentiate. And so this is the mind actually repressing the body by and large. Whereas at the next step, the cognitive structures are rules and roles. And that's how the self fits in what its roles are in the society around it. And so the important issue there at fulcrum 4 is not how the mind fits with the body, but how mind fits with other minds. How my role here plays out, and whether I am playing a healthy role or unhealthy or damaged or falsified or a series of games. And transactional analysis has in particular looked at games people play and have done a really good job of cataloging them and pointing them out and developing techniques for working with them. The first, which is simply to become aware that you are in fact engaged in a game. And all games have their payoffs. So whether it's, you know, I'm smarter than you, I'm humbler than you, I'm more powerful than you, or I can make more money, I'm worthless compared to you. I mean, any number of ways that we interact that are just not true and that have ulterior motives for their payoff. And so that's what the defense mechanism created by the role mind looks like. It's having to do with rules and roles that we engage in our society. So we've moved from how the mind interacts with the body to how mind interacts with other minds. And then the mind can reflect on itself with formal operational thinking. And so you can get some very, very powerful contracting activities up and running with a rational mind. And it's one of the reasons that it just seems to get a bad reputation with almost any approach that's attempting to be spiritual or transformative or liberational. The rational mind is almost always made the devil, along with the ego. So the rational ego is sort of the worst thing you can call somebody if you're on a spiritual path. But part of it comes from the fact that the ego, as self-contraction, at the rational level, can produce some very powerful self-contracting activities, and therefore generate a really enormous trail of shadow material, shadow activity. And the problem, again, with the shadow is every time a shadow is created and pushed out of the self, the authentic self, in a sense, becomes so much smaller than it actually is. And the false self just becomes, in a sense, larger and larger, even though it's actually smaller in a categorical sense. It's a smaller feeling self. And so the false self becomes more and more in charge of what's going on. And that's painful in several ways, not the least of which that it's a deep form of self-deception. It's a deep form of not being honest with yourself about who and what you really are. And the irony in that is that defense mechanisms actually bring about that which they are meant to ward off. And that's why they don't work. So every time you use a defense mechanism, you actually end up increasing the problem you're trying to fix. And that happens because you are introducing more and more self-deception into the system. Self-contraction is operating more and more over time, and therefore more and more suffering enters into the self. And so it's the true irony of defense mechanisms is that they actually do bring about that which they are meant to ward off. And so you find yourself getting more depressed, more anxious, more jealous, more envious, more suicidal, any number of things. The more you attempt to avoid truly becoming conscious and intimate with your shadow. And whatever the shadow is, it can be negative and it can be positive. It can be good qualities and it can be so-called negative or bad qualities. But whatever it is, it's something that belongs to you, something that belongs to your authentic self. And therefore something that is part of your true manifestation in this world. And not being aware of it is indeed, it's the fundamental form of lying. Lying to yourself about what's really going on. And so with that, of course, then you'll start to misread other people because you'll be putting your shadows onto them. And I'm not very controlling, but my boss is a control freak, etc. So all of a sudden, all sorts of things start showing up in the environment that really aren't there. And it's hard to catch because usually the person that you project your shadow onto is somebody that already has that quality. In other words, your boss probably really is controlling. But when you project your controlling self onto your boss's controlling self, you get two controlling selves coming at you. And that's just a little bit overwhelming. And so you're always overreacting to how controlling your boss is. And that will continue until you take back the controlling part of yourself and reintegrate it and make it a part of yourself. And so it's always kind of been understood in the transformative systems of the world that you have to go through some sort of fire-breathing dragon to get to the treasure. And that's always, whatever else it means, it's a very good metaphor or symbol or analogy of having to go through the shadow in order to get to the authentic self. But it becomes more and more important the more you evolve, because these shadows and these false selves, another name for false selves is subpersonalities, are cumulative. They once formed, they stay. They are just sort of there, more or less forever, until you really confront the shadow material that they're hiding. And so it's not uncommon for people to have magenta subpersonalities and red subpersonalities and amber subpersonalities. And that can just continue. And it can continue into the transpersonal realms, as can defense mechanisms and shadow creation and projection. And that's true all the way up to the Overmind. So you can get a whole spectrum of self-deception, a whole spectrum of subpersonalities or false selves. And all of them basically because some aspect of yourself has been cut off, dissociated, and projected. And the real problem with that, as you can continue to develop, is that the false self gets bigger, whereas the authentic self keeps getting smaller and smaller. And so you actually have less and less power of consciousness available. It's getting sucked up all the time by these sub-personalities that keep the same characteristics, the same motivations, the same needs, the same drives that they had when they were split off. So red sub-personalities are still red. And their main motivation is power. And so power will be an issue for somebody with a red sub-personality. They'll either have way too much of a drive to power, or they'll be extremely uncomfortable with it and always seeing it in everybody else and never seeing it themselves. But there goes 10% of your consciousness capacity is into this red sub-personality. And then you get to amber and another 10% is lost. And by the time you're getting into integral levels, even though you're cognitively structured in integral ways, integral only means capacity. It doesn't mean what's actually there. In other words, you can be at an integral stage and still project something. Still associate something. It's just going to be a very complex projection. it's going to be a complex perspective that's being denied and makes somebody feel uncomfortable. Somebody, not a typical bad guy, but somebody working for an oil company can be at second tier and actually be repressing the reality or the totality, the importance of the ecosystem, and is actually pushing that awareness out of their mind. And that allows them to continue functioning in a way that they think isn't really hurting anything. And so it just the fact that it's an integral level doesn't mean that it's integrated. It means that it can be. And for the first time, can integrate all the previous levels. And that's never happened before. That's not a potential available to any first tier level. And so it makes second tier very unique, but not automatically healthy. And so you can arrive at second tier with 10, 20, 30, 40% of your consciousness, capacity available to you, and how to order and direct your awareness, is gone. It's not available to you. And operates at its own, in its own way, at its own time, whenever it wants to. It's always reactive. It's always reacting to something that it sees or thinks it sees in the environment. And you're always free of it. You're just merely reacting to something nasty out there that should be taken care of and isn't. And so by the time you get to third tier, you could literally have sort of run out of gas and had projected, dissociated enough of your authentic self that you can't just keep climbing anymore. And this is unfortunate because at that point the pain is so bad that it's very likely a time a person will go looking for spiritual remedies because it's just so bad they can't stand it anymore. And most of the forms of spirituality, if they're not merely fundamentalist, mythic, regressive, amber, will be past great liberation that acknowledge the true self, but not the authentic self. Any form of individual selfhood will be equated with self-contraction. So there's no real way that most forms of spirituality can deal with shadow issues very well. Because in order to handle the shadow, you're being asked to build a self. You're being asked to actually work on making yourself authentic. And in most spiritual traditions, they only acknowledge the true self. And so your authentic self is confused with the self-contraction itself. And it's looked at as something that you need to get rid of. And so whenever your authentic self comes up, it's beaten down, pushed away, neglected, merely observed away, attempted to transcend, but not befriended, and not become an intimate part of your manifestation and expression of what you are in this world. and the qualities and the factors that make you who you are. And with these denied, dissociated, tossed out, then you're much, much less than you can be. And it's another sort of oddity that in many cases what is appearing as a negative in your own mind is actually due to the projection of a positive, something positive about yourself that you were either told you didn't have, it was somehow kind of beat out of you by your parents, or it was a role that you ended up adopting early on due to some weird educational experiences. Everybody always says Catholic education upbringings just ruined them. So this is always, you know, that particular nun in the fourth grade that completely ruined their life. So we'll guess that that's an example of how it can happen. But becoming less and less and less and less as the authentic self shrinks and shrinks and shrinks, and the false self gains and gains and gains. So one of the really important reasons for having integral approaches to therapy and spirituality is they are virtually the only ones that acknowledge both of these selves, and that teach you techniques to both realize your transcendental self, the pure witness, the I, and to reclaim your shadow and fuse it with the false self in order to generate your authentic self, who you truly are as a manifest being, who you are as an infinite being. It's your true self, your unique self, your real self. And the spiritual tradition will help you discover that. But in the process, it often will not only not help find the shadow, they can make it worse. Because what it's trying to do in terms of transcending the self is also factors that act to contract and push away the self. And they're the same factors in many cases. So simple witnessing, which is a fundamental meditative practice, is fine, except if something is actually dissociated. And then when it comes up, it will come up in its dissociated form. And all you will do is give it more attention in its dissociated form, therefore making it stronger because it's got more attention, but not corrected. Well, that doesn't come in the instructions on how to correct what you're witnessing. Witnessing is just what the ultimate self is doing, and it makes no distinctions. But the authentic self, you have to make a distinction. This is true and false. This is right, this is wrong. This is self, this is not self. And that's exactly what witnessing meditation won't do. And so it can just increase dissociation. Witnessing, 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 dissociating, 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 not touching, not touching, not touching. And so your shadow is just learning how to dig in this new atmosphere. He has probably never been assaulted with pure awareness. But when it is, it easily adapts and will actually agree with the witnessing. Because you're seeing it as an it. And that's what it's going to keep saying. That's right, I'm an it. I'm not an I. So you don't have anything to worry about. So, witnessing, the shadow stays unintegrated. And so, with integral approaches, the therapist is aware of this and will use techniques that work with shadow as well as techniques that work with self. And both of those obviously being really important.